morning. I call to order the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. Today is Wednesday, November 19th, and the time is 10:03 a.m. Please silence all cell phones. Thank you. We have the following members present. Representative Josephson, Representative Kopp, Representative Tilton, Speaker Edgman, Senator Stedman, Senator Giesel, Senator Wilikowski online, and myself, Senator Gary Jackson. We have a quorum to conduct business. We've also been joined by Representative Colum, and I don't see any other legislators in the audience or online at this moment. First, I'd like to thank Sophia Tenney from House Records, who is participating remotely, and Mike, Dana, Ian, and Tristan from the Anchorage LIO for supporting this committee this morning. The committee has important issues on the agenda this morning, and I want to thank everyone for being here today. We hope to adjourn the meeting by noon. We'll take a break for lunch, and we'll return this afternoon for another meeting with presentations and discussions about the Alaska LNG project. Since Vice Chair Fields is unable to join us today due to another legislative commitment, we've asked Senator Speaker Edgman to make the motions during the meeting to keep things moving efficiently. So before we get started, are there any questions? Okay. We're at agenda item number 2, approval of agenda. Mr. Speaker, may I please have a motion for approval of the agenda?
I move and ask unanimous consent that the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee agenda is presented.
Thank you. Is there any objection? I don't see any. Agenda is approved. We're at agenda item number 3, approval of the minutes. Mr. Speaker, may I have a motion for approval of the minutes?
I move that the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee approve the minutes of the meeting on September 12th.
Thank you. Is there any objection? I don't see an objection. The minutes are approved. We're now at agenda item 4, A, top audit issues. This item is for discussion only, so no votes will be taken. Ms. Curtis is going to give us an important overview of the top audit issues identified by the division. So before you begin, Ms. Curtis, welcome on behalf of the committee, legislation, all the lessons. I want to thank you and your team for your hard work and dedication. I also want to let the general public know that the Division of Legislative Audit, it serves as one of the legislature's most significant checks in the balance of powers with the executive branch and judicial branches of government. The division's primary responsibilities are to provide transparency and hold state agencies accountable to state and federal laws. Audits inform the legislature and the public about government operations. So again, welcome. Ms. Curtis, please proceed.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Ms. Curtis. I'm your state legislative auditor. Around 4 years ago, this committee developed a new audit oversight process to encourage corrective action for audit. This process starts by identifying the top audit issues from the previous fiscal year, which I will do today. Then the committee asks for the status of corrective action from state agencies. I facilitate that process by sending a letter to state departments. Then I will come back at the next meeting, summarize the status of corrective action, at which point the committee may decide to forward some of these audit findings to other legislative committees for further follow-up monitoring during the next legislative session. So for FY25, we have 12 audit issues, and they start with the Commercial Passenger Vessel Environmental Compliance Fund. This is called the CPVEC Fund. This is a subfund of the general fund. During our audit of the FY24 financial statements, we found that some of the fund balance for this fund was not being reported accurately. This fund has two funding sources, the Environmental Compliance Fee and the Ocean Ranger Program. In working with Legislative Legal, we believe it is very likely that both of these funding sources are likely subject to the federal tonnage clause. That means that both these funding sources must be used for specific purposes in order to be legal. It also means that the fund balance would be restricted and not swept into the CPR. Department of Law does not agree with this interpretation, and this resulted in what we believe is a misstatement in the financial statements. And unless this issue is resolved, it will continue to be a top audit issue and a finding in future. Second is a disclaimed opinion on the state's financial statements, meaning that we cannot provide an opinion. And that was because we had a lack of evidence on the effectiveness of the Medicaid system internal controls. The Department of Health did not obtain its annual report on internal controls for the Medicaid system. This report is contractually required from its vendor that hosts its system and helps process the Medicaid claims. The annual review of the Medicaid system, the claims and claims processing controls did not occur because the department had trouble transitioning to a new vendor. And that Medicaid system processed $2.4 billion of claims in FY24, and without assurance over the operating effectiveness of internal controls, we could not provide an opinion for several general fund accounts, the most material being expenditures in federal grants and aid revenues. The third POP audit issue is an unsupported accounts receivable in the accounting system associated with the Department of Health. The department could not provide support for the $26.6 million receivable. It was initially recorded back in 2017, and we first asked for support in 2019. Every year we come back and ask for support, and they have been unable to provide it since FY19. I think it's this year we wanted to elevate it as a top audit issue. If you're not familiar with the term receivable, it means that an agency recognizes revenue for services they believe they have earned. So revenue they believe they've earned. So they did that back in 17, but they could not provide support. Department of Health stated that they had insufficient resources to conduct the complex reconciliation needed to identify the federal programs related to that receivable and to collect funds. Top audit issue number four. This it relates to the nationwide settlement of opioid funds or opioids settlements. Alaska was a party to these settlements, and they did receive around $23 million in FY24. We noted that these funds have to be used for specific purposes. And when we were auditing the FY24 financial statements, there was an error in how those funds were reported, and that was corrected via an audit adjustment. But we noted that the state does not have accounting structures in place to track the receipt and expenditure of those funds. So we made a recommendation to the legislature and Office of Management Budget to work together to establish accounting structures to appropriately and accurately monitor the receipt and expenditure of those funds. And they are expected to receive these settlement monies in future years. Okay, issue number five. This is a new finding for FY24 of financial statements. We did cycle and procurement testing for this year. We sampled small procurements and large procurements, and we had an high error rate. 33% of the procurements we tested either did not comply with the procurement law or the departments did not maintain support to demonstrate compliance with the procurement law. We ended up writing findings for seven state departments, separate departments, including the Department of Administration's Chief Procurement Officer to improve training statewide for procurement. Top audit issue number six. This is a very significant issue. This has to do with monies not billed or expenditures not billed to the federal government in a timely manner. This is a COVID-related disaster grant that was awarded to Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. That department passed through this grant to Department of Health and Social Services, and that was the department that incurred the expenditures related to COVID. Now, how this is supposed to work is then the Department of Health and Social Services would provide support for all of these expenditures to Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. DMVA would then create what's called project worksheets, submit them to FEMA, get approval for those expenditures, and then draw down funds to reimburse the state for the expenditures. Due to a lot of reasons, the split of the department, staff shortages, competing priorities, Department of Health and Social Services and initially and then Department of Health did not collect that support and bill those expenditures to DMVA. So what ended up happening is the state had not received reimbursement for the $280 million related to these to this disaster grant, meaning the state did not receive investment revenue for the if those monies had been invested, they would have received investment revenue from that. We conservatively calculated lost revenue to the state as around $9 million. The next top audit issue is Department of Corrections overspending their FY24 budget. This was just a matter of poor internal controls and not monitoring their budget. It was their population management appropriation that governs their prisons. They did not adequately track their budget and ended up overspending their appropriation by $8. The next top audit issue is unaddressed shortfalls. And if you're unfamiliar with the term shortfall, that means that a department may have overspent their general funded portion of an appropriation. Appropriation may have multiple funding sources. For instance, it could be funded by the general fund and by federal funds. So if an agency does not receive, for instance, the federal funds that they had budgeted during the year, an agency is supposed to restrict their appropriation so they do not overspend the general portion of their appropriation. This is something we test for every year. And every year we find numerous departments that when we look at the accounting system, it appears that they're in short. We let those agencies know. Sometimes it's just a matter of making a corrective entry in the accounting system or billing for the revenues, and that that the appropriation really isn't truly in shortfall. And sometimes agencies are truly in shortfall, and they have to come to the legislature to request ratification for an appropriation. I'm highlighting these three departments as a top audit issue because these departments have not timely addressed their shortfalls, and we're seeing them year after year. So those departments are Department of Law, Department of Natural Resources, and the Department. The next top audit issue is the Alaska International Airports not getting their outside audit done in a timely manner. You've heard me talk about this the last 2 years. This is the third year. The comptroller stated that they did not receive information timely from Division of Finance. Their outside auditor had to reassign staff that were initially assigned to their audit to other projects, and they had to wait for staff to come back. Of the delays, and then they had some errors that the auditors found in conducting their audit. All of those situations contributed to their late audit that was received, I believe, end of April 2025. And this is a major enterprise fund, so if we don't see their audit in time, that delays the state's opinion on their financial statements. Now, the 10th top audit issue is something that we've had in this presentation for the last 3 years. This is the fourth year. This has to do with material weaknesses and material noncompliance associated with major federal programs administered by Department of Health's Division of Assistance. Everyone's aware of the struggles of this department, put it in the media, related to food stamps and Medicaid eligibility. We continue to find material noncompliance with programs administered by the division. What does it mean when you have material noncompliance? It means that that program has to be audited the next year instead of on it once every three-year cycle. That is additional audit burden on our staff, and it's also a burden on the division staff that have to respond to our questions and provide us information. It's not in anyone's best interest to have these programs routinely audited, but that's the situation we're in. We did not really see any improvements with the division for the FY20 profit. And then the next two top audit issues are associated with performance audits. This first one is a sunset audit of the parole board. We had three recommendations made to the board and the department, and I think these are material enough to us to reach out to them and ask for their current status of corrective action. And then lastly is the performance audit of the Office of Children's Services. This audit was the third and final audit. When foster care reform passed back in 2018, it had multiple different laws, and they had different effective dates. And so there was three separate audits scheduled to evaluate compliance with the various laws that went into place. And since this was the third and final, took a step back and looked at just at the big picture, how effective has foster care reform been at improving the services for Alaska's children. And this has many conclusions, and it also has six recommendations. And so I won't go through them individually, but recommendations related to hiring and training are especially important. So I wanted to raise that as a top audit issue and ask for the current status regarding corrective action. So if it's the will of the committee, the next step will be to send letters on behalf of the committee to these state agencies, ask, hey, what's your current status, your corrective action? Then I'll bring that status back to the committee at the next meeting, at which point, again, you may decide that you want to highlight some of these findings for other legislative committees to consider during the next legislative session.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Curtis. I appreciate that. On behalf of the committee, please request the status of correct action from the appropriate state agencies for all 12 audit issues. Thank you. So are there any questions for Ms. Curtis? Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm just kind of curious, going back in time when we had all the COVID money that came through, the pass-through federal money, is there any corrective action on some of those appropriations that some of them are fairly apparent that they were, you know, out of compliance, I guess, is the way we're putting it? Is the federal government ever looking at that, or are they just going to ignore it?
Through the chair, I am unaware of any action the federal government has taken in regards to these COVID findings that we had. For instance, that audit on ADA and DCCD on the small business loan program. There was a federal desk review going on that I have not heard back on any results of that federal desk review. So I'm unaware of any type of ramifications that have come from that specific.
Madam Chair.
Senator Buesen, did you have a question?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Clapp.
Thank you. Chris, for this report. Reading through this, I see a theme of lack of staff resources, lack of training, and errors committed by new, inexperienced, or poorly trained staff. You've been at this job for a long time. Can you tell me, is this typical? Is this part of a trend that seems to be building this way? Or can you give us context, like over the last 10, 15 years?
Certainly, through the chair. Senator Kopp, yes, we have seen, I can give you some perspective. We have seen degradation within the department's internal controls. I believe that's a fact of lack of documented written procedures. That's an often time we say, oh, you have continued turnover. Written procedures are really important. A lack of experience at the agencies. Everyone knows that the state of Alaska had a really hard time with hiring, but not just hiring, retaining. Constant churn out at those agencies. When there's lots of jobs, people tend to jump jobs, continually jump. So, yes, I think that we're seeing a lack of experience, lots of turnover, vacancies. I think we see general poor training. That's within the Division of Public Assistance. I think that might be a result of inexperienced folks doing the training or, again, lack of written procedures. It's gotten progressively worse. I can't say FY25 was any worse than FY24, but going back 10 years, every year, that point, seeing more findings. We used to have 35 findings around, 30 to 35 findings in single audit. We have 80, 90 findings now.
Any other questions for Ms. Josephson?
Through the chair, Ms. Curtis, your number 12 item. I'm just curious how this makes the list. I mean, I understand why it's the list. But for example, a typical board or commission audit, you will report back. They will respond. You'll report back, etc. How is this? Didn't that already happen with OCS? In other words, aren't all the facts more or less known? There were 3 volumes. Publish those. Why is this on the list? This is one of
certainly through the chair. This process looks back at the audits issued during FY20, and it's designed to hit the top audit issues with the idea of asking about where a department is within their corrective action findings. We do not have any other mechanism, and that's why I think this was created, to follow up on status recommendations for performance audits. For sunsets, when we come back the next cycle, which could be up to 8 years later, follow up, for the statewide single audit, certain types of the recommendations are followed up every year. But for performance audits, this process is specifically designed for things like the OCS audit, where there is no other mechanism to evaluate the status of corrective action going forward.
Thank you.
Any representative Tillotson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Where do the opioid funds lay right now? Are you aware of that?
Through the chair, Representative Tillotson, they came in. We were able to see them as deposits. This is back. I don't really know about FY25. Haven't yet. But FY24, we were able to see them. I'm not sure what raised our attention to the fact that they weren't reported accurately. But it was $23 million for FY24, and we know they're continuing to get those funds. And they have to be used for type of remediation type of tasks associated with opioids.
So but they came in and what? I'm going to be asking specific accounting questions and not audit questions. Forgive me if I am, but what account did they come through, or what?
Through the chair of the Quebec. You know, they came into the general fund, but we don't know what structures. They recorded in the general fund and got mixed up with everything else.
Okay.
And they weren't highlighted as opioid, or they weren't tracked. There were some problems within the division, admin services within the Department of Administration. There were some communications with law. Sometimes these settlement monies come through law on what exactly they are, what do they mean. It would be really important to track, since you have to show compliance with the settlement. Either it could be a subfund of the general fund, or it could be a special revenue fund, possibly.
Thank you.
Yep. Okay. Doesn't look like there are any other questions. Okay, thank you, Ms. Kurtz. That was a great presentation. So we are now at agenda item 4. B, contract approval for data SNP. Mr. Speaker, I have a motion for the data SNP contract.
Madam Chair, I move and ask unanimous consent that the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee authorize the legislative auditor to enter into a contract data SNP purchase audit software for an amount not to exceed $60,000 paid from existing funds.
Thank you, and I'll object for the purposes of discussion. Ms. Curtis, will you please share the information about the contract?
For the record, this is Chris Curtis, your state auditor. In your meeting packets, you have a memo asking for your consideration and approval for a contract with DataSniffer for audit software not to exceed $60,000. I first became aware of this audit tool from a vendor who contacted me, scheduled a meeting to hear their sales pitch, canceled it a few times due to competing priorities, but then learned more about this tool at the National State Auditors Association conference this last June. I was in a roundtable with many other state auditors, and they were talking about how they have effectively used this tool, and they highly recommended it. So I also observed a presentation during the conference, thought this might be something that we could use, and I agreed to listen to a sales pitch with some other audit managers. After listening to their tool, we decided we want to try it out in our office, and we piloted it for 4 weeks. A little bit more about DataSniffer. It's an add-on tool with Excel, and it's used for test of details, walkthroughs, and other audit procedures. It helps staff document and review audit evidence more efficiently. Further, it allows for the use of DocuMine, which is an AI-powered solution within DataSniffer that eliminates manual searches through lengthy documents. Staff can ask specific questions to multiple documents and receives precise answers. It generates those answers, and staff can drill down to the support for the answers by simply clicking. We used it on a test basis to test reports. It helps in the review of the testing. We can look at where they got the answer viewing the testing. We used it to test board minutes. We added, gave precise questions to like 800 pages of board minutes and got the responses. So after the test, the staff really thought it was a good idea to buy this tool. So we're thinking it's a good idea. It's, we're going to give it a shot for a year, see. Everyone's going to have a license, and we're going to see whether, just what degree it makes us more efficient and more effective. And it's a first step towards automating our audit procedures, which I think is where we're going to go in the future. It's not a competitive procurement. The document provides explanations of why we believe this qualifies as an unsolicited offer within the procurement code. And the amount is, again, not to exceed $60,000. I do have availability within my existing budget.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Okay, so I'll withdraw my objection. Are there any other objections? Great, seeing none, then data sniffer contract approved. Thank you. We are now at agenda item 4C, RPLs. Speaker Edgman, may I please have a motion for approval of our first RPL?
I move and ask unanimous consent that the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee approve RPL number 16-2026-054, Rural Health Transformation Program, $200 million.
Thank you. I will object for the purposes of discussion. Alexi Painter, Director of the Division of Legislative Finance, is with us telephonically. We are joined in the room by Lacey Sanders, Director of Office of Management and Budget, and Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner, Department of Health. Megan Wallace, Chief Counsel for Legislative Legal Services. She's also online and will be available to answer any questions after the presentation. Mr. Painter, you're first up. Please introduce this RPL to the committee, and then we'll receive additional details and a short presentation about the Rural Health Transformation Program from Director Sanders and Commissioner Hyde. Welcome, Mr. Painter.
Thank you. For the record, Alexi Painter, the Legislative Fiscal Analyst. So starting with RPL number 16-2026-0154 for the Department of Health. It's in the Departmental Support Services Appropriation, the Administrative Support Services Allocation. It's a total of $200 million of federal receipts, fund code 1002, and it provides federal receipt authority for the Rural Health Transformation Program. Since the commissioner and the OMB director are presenting on some of the details, I'll be brief. The Rural Health Transformation Program was established under the federal One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which passed Congress in July this year. Since that was after the legislature had adjourned, this was not part of our budget. That we passed a couple of months before that. This is a completely new program, and it will provide an estimated $200 million per year over the next 5 years. Department of Health has already submitted Alaska's application for this program earlier this month, and the federal government must issue a decision on awarding these funds by December 31st of this year. So this is a timely RPL because the funds may be delivered to the state before the legislature convenes again. Each year's funding is available for a two-year expenditure window, so there is some interest in getting the funds out the door quickly. And the department stated that having the federal authority earlier will ensure that they can accept the award and execute sub-awards on schedule to meet that time frame. There's no matching requirement for this grant, and there's existing federal authority in this allocation of a bit under $4 million. This will increase that to $204 million. The question we would have on this RPL is largely about whether this constitutes really a new appropriation, since this is not just an expansion of an existing program. This is some new activities. And I think Ms. Wallace can speak to that better than I can about whether this is allowable under the statute. And essentially, given the obvious timeliness of the RPL and the limited ability of the legislature to influence how the funds would be spent, the policy call for the committee is essentially evaluating that risk against the benefit of having timely distribution of this funding. And that's the conclusion of my comments. I'm happy to answer questions as well.
Thank you. I'd like to recognize Representative Prox, who joined the meeting at 10:25. Are there any questions for Mr. Payne? Okay, and we'll proceed. Ms. Sanders and Commissioner Hedberg, please join us and proceed with your presentation. Welcome.
Good Good morning, everyone. For the record, my name is Lacey Sanders. I am the director for the Office of Management and Budget, and we have Commissioner.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner. And I will do a high-level overview of the slide deck just to orientate everyone to the real health transformation. So July 4th, the president signed in H.R. 1. It's a reconciliation bill, and that created the transformation. It's a $50 billion federal opportunity to allow states to modernize their health care system. The $50 billion is really split into two buckets. $25 billion will be equally allocated to states. The second portion, the other half, is $25 billion, and that will be allocated to states based off of their rural nature. And I would say that Alaska is very positioned for this opportunity. Immediately right after July 4th, we reached out to our healthcare partners. This is a significant opportunity for us, and we will be the very first state to issue a request for information out to our healthcare partners. We had well over 160 responses that represented well over 400 different ideas. And on this slide, you can see the representation of the different types of responses to the RFI. A summary of the RFI is posted on our website. We have, the Department of Health has been incredibly busy since July, really working very closely with all of our healthcare partners. In addition to the RFI, we created an advisory committee that we're meeting with, and we have held well over 30 different meetings with different healthcare providers to really talk about what is the Rural Health Transformation Program, what it is not, what are the challenges, and how can we work together. Through a lot of that dialogue, created these three goals that are on slide four before you. And underneath each of these three goals, you will see blue boxes. Those represent the six core initiatives. That's truly the heart of the application. The first three, goal one, is really about people. It's about patients. It's about clients. It's healthy beginnings, increasing access, and healthy communities. The second goal is about pay for value. Alaska has a fee-for-service system, and we need to shift into alternative payment models for fiscal sustainability. And so that is one goal and one initiative dedicated to that space. The third is very topic specific. It's continuing to strengthen our healthcare workforce and to leverage technology appropriately to support our clients and providers. Through this true partnership with working with healthcare providers across the state, we have been posting the various iterations of the initiatives on our website, and you'll see there's three different versions, and I think that's really a reflection that they have updated based off of the feedback from our providers. And so the final version that was submitted in the application is on our website. There are restrictions on how these funds can be used. They cannot be used for new construction, but they can be used for renovations. And I think that was that's important because a lot of our healthcare providers said that we need capital funds to build out our infrastructure. So that is not, new construction is not allowed, renovations it's allowed. So we're going to see a lot of focus in that area shortly. These funds cannot supplant existing operations. They truly are focused at the heart, which is transforming the healthcare system. And then there's administrative caps. So the Department of Health, we can only use up to 10%. That is both direct and indirect. Again, the intent is this fund goes out to communities. There's a very aggressive timeline associated with administering these funds, and I'm not going to go into a lot of details, but really what to say is that these funds are based off of the federal fiscal year. Year one, we will receive our funds, so next week, just in a couple of weeks, we anticipate hearing or receiving our notice of grant award, and that really starts... the clock for us. All states are in the same position. So year one, we need to appropriately allocate and incur those costs. And then we have a second year to spend down those expenditures. And that just continues to roll through those 5 years. States that do not spend down those funds, the CMS will take those funds back and reallocate out to the other states. And so that's where the close working relationship that we have with our healthcare providers across the state, setting up the system to appropriately and accurately allocate those funds out based off those 6 initiatives. That's why we're before you today to ask for the federal authority to receive those funds so that we can start to allocate those funds in the beginning of 2026 and really position Alaska to be a state that is a state that would be able to receive other funds from other states that isn't well advanced in setting up their system to administer the Rural Health Transformation Program. That was, again, a very high-level overview of the program, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Thank you. Are there any questions for our presenters or Ms. Wallace?
Madam Chair.
Speaker Edgman.
Yes, thank you for the presentation. I guess starting at the ground level, since this is the first presentation I've had, or been, you know, anybody that's heard this, this topic. So money... See, just at the very high end level, just money flows into the state of Alaska. It's already been determined by federal entities who's going to be the recipient, who's actually qualified for the various parameters of the fund. And then it'll flow through our budget process, which is right today. But in terms of any discretion at the state side, I heard the term renovations. That's very much a term of art. As I understand it, I think that that's a term built regularly here at the state budgeting process. Maybe on the federal side, that's defined. But is there any discretion on the state side in terms of where these dollars actually go, applied beyond what decision making has happened on the federal side?
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner. For the Department of Health, excuse me. So in terms of who is eligible for these funds, in the federal bill, it actually outlines who is eligible. And so it's, and I'm not going to go through the list because it is extensive, but all of the health care entities in the state of Alaska would be eligible. The focus is to transform the healthcare system. And while it's focusing on rural communities, we know that there's going to be a statewide impact. And so all communities will be eligible for these funds. The process, the federal bill was very clear what the intent of this was. This is a federal grant, just like all of the other federal grants that we administer. We submit an application. It is a cooperative agreement. And so we will enter with CMS and states. These are the 6 initiatives that we have, again, which is why we have such a strong working relationship partnership with all of our healthcare entities to say, what is the structure to create guardrails that are aligned to the federal purpose but be broad enough to capture what the future intents may be, future activities? Because we only have 1 application that covers that 5 years. We only had 7 weeks to create this application. We were under a short period of time. So we created the structure based off of the federal intent. And what we intend is, for the first year, there's going to be a lot of planning that needs to happen in order to really make sure that it's appropriate, it's sustainable. I think that's a key element with this Rural Health Transformation Fund, is that we had to demonstrate how this is going to be sustainable, because it's one-time funding. And we need to ensure that communities that are applying for this demonstrate again, how is this sustainable? How are you transforming access to health care? Does that answer your question?
Certainly.
Yeah, it does. And it's interesting. There's $200 million a year to Alaska. 5 years, you had 160 responses. It's, that's a little over $1 million if you did 160 equally. I'm presuming that's probably not how it's going to work out. But it's also fascinating to know that whether it's modernizing, transitioning in this new phase of less funding coming to Alaska, I presume it's wrong. Please correct me if I'm wrong, because I think that's the intent of the big bill is to actually help cost savings, right? So this 5-year fund is really, you're not transitory. But it's interesting that a lot of needs in Alaska are tied to capital, right? Healthcare system, housing is a big component. And I see that there's a limit of only 20% of capital expenditures. And henceforth, my question earlier about renovations, because that's interpretive. For someone hearing it the first time, and I'm just wondering, what role do you have, given that, as I understand, the Big Beautiful Bill, this was basically a budget line item that was sort of programmatically constructed after the fact. You just stated here in the state, that's what you're doing, sort of doing the state's role. And I'm still not clear just exactly, as we are running breathlessly towards getting the applications in and then getting people back to Alaska, what role the state's going to play, saying that there's a, possible out rural Alaska, true rural Alaska versus larger hospital in Anchorage, which is also considered rural as well by definition. And how do you get through all that, or have you even determined that yet? Or I'm probably way ahead of the curve in terms of those questions.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative, those are all very, very good questions. And I think some of those questions, we're still waiting for CMS to make some, to provide guidelines when it comes to capital and renovations. So I think CMS is going to direct all states what those parameters are. Second, I think when it comes to entities applying for funds, right now we are working with an advisory committee that is helping us craft the scoring matrix for how to rank applications. Again, there are factors, if a hospital wants to work on workforce, and part of their workforce is they lack housing, they lack childcare, which are two critical elements that you need for employees to come live in the community, work at the hospital. We built that into the application. But the funds are not allowed to build a new child care facility. You can renovate space to have a child care facility. You can't build a new housing, but you can renovate space for housing. So those are examples on how to tie in what are the needs of the community, what are the parameters that have been set so far, Rural Health Transformation Program by CMS to, again, strengthen workforce, which is one of the key initiatives in the grant. What we are anticipating, and we are still working through the development process, is that we want to ensure that everyone has equal access to understanding how to apply. What are the decisions on how funding will be allocated is not going to be a set amount to an entity. It's going to be competitive, but we need to make sure that it's equally competitive. For the most smallest communities that don't have staffing in order to apply, to the large entities that really support smaller communities through telehealth or other different modalities of healthcare. So we're in the development phase right now with that process. We do intend to post that on our website. We've been driving people to our website to answer the questions and hear the updates to the development of the Rural Health Transformation.
Madam Chair, just sort of a wrap-up question, maybe more of a comment. I'm not going to propose this, obviously, this report timeline is quite critical. But it just strikes me that through the revised program, language program. I think RPL, if I got that right, you know, statutory language that goes back to the late 70s or possibly the 80s, quite antiquated to this whole issue of discussion. But here we are in lieu of the Finance Committee and the formal appropriation process sort of handing on something that does involve discretion later on at the executive level. That, you know, I think we're granting this authority and allowing this whole built along the way. And, I mean, I can't presume that you'd ever go back to a finance committee for any authority because you've been granted the authority this action that we're about to take today. So I'm not opposing it, but I'm just, you know, in terms of the discovery process, trying to figure out what exactly we're doing here and how much sort of quote unquote blank check authority that we're handing to administration.
Senator, if I may follow up as a comment to Representative Edgemond's comments. We will be back for the finance committees in the future. So this was an initial $200 million request. You will need additional future to address whatever number is determined by CMS. This is a 5 allocation, so there are more awards to the state of Alaska, not just two. So we'll be back for you again during the legislative session that's coming in January. We can provide an update to finance committees what our finance was, what we're doing, additional work at that point in time, and then what the future years will be like as far as if you receive federal awards over the next 5 years.
Representative Josephson was first in the House. Representative Josephson.
Thank you. I think Senator Cecil would like to thank you. Commissioner, I know that you're well along in the process, and I've been as involved as I can be and had meetings with various entities about what I applaud doing. I assume at this point you don't know, you haven't been awarded the $200 million, which is on top of the other base amount, and so you haven't made any decisions about how it would be spent. Is that
for the record, Heidi Hedberg, through the chair, Representative Josephson, you are correct. So what we know based off of the federal language, the federal bill, is that every state is guaranteed $100 million per year if I submit an application. The second tranche of funding is really dependent on how rural your state is, what type of health care system you have, and that's what we are waiting. What we know is that Alaska is well positioned because when we compare Alaska's healthcare system to a difference. We also do not have state directed payments. We do not have provider taxes. We are the only state that does not have those two factors. That was part of the creation of this rural health transformation, which is what sets us apart with real funds to truly transform the healthcare system. And so we do anticipate, again, back to Director Sanders, we do anticipate coming back to the legislature session to ask for additional federal authority. We'll definitely have more work that we can present to flush out the process and the intent behind the development of this rural health transformation. In December is when CMS will communicate to all states of award what the actual amount will be.
Certainly.
When these dollars appear in the governor's budget, they're not going to be outlined the way we do TVEP, for example, where we say these are the winners. And I hate to talk about winners, but that's sort of, you know, reality. The nature of them is that you're the selectors, and there's going to be a single, maybe two lines in the budget. And if we wish to find out how it's being spent and want to sort of dig deeper, that's allowable. But is that how the budget will look, I guess, for Director Sanders?
Through the chair, for the record, this is Lacey Sanders. I apologize. I did not introduce myself earlier. that's a conversation that we can have during the legislative process. I imagine that we have a separate appropriation application for this funding in the budget, as you're talking about. If you want to have a conversation about what that looks like during legislative session to expand on that, we can definitely have that conversation for visibility, but we will definitely be outlining it as a separate component application. I'm open to the conversation about how just like to see that laid out. We just don't want to be limiting ourselves through the appropriation process to be able to meet the needs of what the committee or the council decides on allocating.
Just a quick follow-up. Sure. But the legislature will not say, geez, we think the tech availability at the Yakutat Hospital is adequate, so we don't want to fund that. We want to fund Fort Yuka. We're not getting into that sort of weeds.
Chair, correct.
Thank you. Senator Steadman?
First, just a clarification, if I understand the process here. This doesn't fit the normal appeal. We're going to basically put a blind eye to it to accelerate the receiving of this funds a few months early until June. Budget summit, and then bless it in the budget process. Sure, question. And then this is going to be an annual event that the OMB will be coming in the budget, laying this out as a separate appropriation, how they allocated the fund so we can track it historically. And each year will be a separate process. So this is just an acceptance for the first $200 million for this budget cycle to accelerate receiving them, so we don't have to wait 7 months to get these monies into the economy. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Steadman, that is correct. The RPL process through the LBMA is what we have as a tool right to bring this item to the legislature. And you are correct, we will bring this forward through the budget process on a basis for the legislature's consideration.
Madam Chairman, one thing we don't want to do is create a system where it becomes automatic, you know, with precedent. So we've got to be kind of careful with that. Representatives come to the corporate power of the legislature. It's something we'd like to keep for whatever reason. So the... And then if I could just make a recommendation, we have several programs within the state. I'll reference the matching grant fund, where we have the harbors apply. The department ranks them. We don't get into the political monkey business. But every year we see the ranking when they're done. We can have questions to the department why, you know, one harbor's rank 5 and not number 4 or whatever. Compare it from year. So I would recommend that when you think about doing this, you come up with some way that it would be easy to communicate that information of selection to the legislature. What you don't want to do is have politics involved in that decision. Not that you would have politics. But then so there's that. And then on the 20% or $20 million that can go to refurbishment, a lot of rural hospitals that are in desperate need of refurbishment, some of them replacement. So I think that would be interesting, and clinics. So I think that's going to be an interesting endeavor to go through, sort that out, rank them, and try to fix. And I think they could probably use more than $20 million a year, frankly.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, through the chair, thank you, Senator, for those comments. I think there's a lot of interest in these funds and how these funds are going to be used. So to the earlier comments, we do intend to have a dashboard that reflects who has received funds, what are the funds being used for. We want to set that up as quickly as we can. In addition, I think... first part that we're engaging in starting next week, traveling to communities to have face-to-face conversations to ensure everyone's aware of the Rural Health Transformation Plan and what it is and what it is not, what the intent is. And we will be having a virtual meeting so that we can educate everyone to apply for these funds. And then this summer, we do intend to have a regional meeting because really we need healthcare, hospitals, clinics, provider groups working together, coordinating a strong system that needs to happen at the regional level. So that these funds are not intended to be isolated. For one-offs, and so a lot of this work is going to be building as we progress through the year due to the condensed time of this application became available to become the first year. It's just really condensed and skimmed fast and furious, but we very much are open to feedback in this process, and we can follow and have to have conversations.
Just a follow-up question. When we look back at COVID, we had funds come into the state. We were very clear. So try to be very clear. There's an intent to backfill these with the end. And as soon as they ended, before they ended, tears started flying and the clinics came out and, you know, off we go to, you got to backfill these funds. So I think that's a message that should be very clear to the recipients that this is five-year money and don't expect the state to back this when it ends. It looks to me like this would end political says to get enough votes to get that particular piece of beautiful bill across the finish line. So something very clear to the recipients as they don't hesitate in the legislature and want to know we're not backfilling these funds.
Thank you.
Of course, we blame it on OMB, of course.
Thank you. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll underscore what Senator Stidman just brought up. Sustainability piece of this going to be left holding the bag end of these 5 years, and that's a concern to me. Also of concern to me is I'm remembering the single audit, and it was very extensive. In calling out accounting problems in the Department of Health. So now here's an additional $200 million grant potentially could be coming every year, and I am concerned about the accounting capabilities of the department. We talked about that earlier related to another subject. I think what might have been informative for this committee would have been the November 7th release that you had of the transformation program initiatives. You list six initiatives in here which more extensively describe each aspect of this alleged transformation. It's very comprehensive, and I think the question about rural Alaska and where fit in would be answered if you could see these initiatives. They were publicly released. I think it would have been informative to have it before the committee today. It would have answered some questions. I'm not going to oppose this RPL, but I do think that we need to keep track of how the money is spent and making sure that it is being appropriately used and accounted. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Josephson.
If there's no one left in the queue.
I'm in the queue.
All right, Representative Pop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Sanders, and thank you very much for presenting this. And it's clear that what the timing of the resolution, the bill coming right at the end of the legislature session, and then having to have these conversations when we're not in session is really what's driving this. It's nothing other than here's the tool that we're using, and that's well understood. Appreciate it. You guys are doing. Question I have is, it seems like a lot of the global hospital funding questions, Senator Stedman touched on that, the care coordination system we have in place, the desire to provide better continuums of care in all areas,
That's kind of the very heart of what a state health authority would do. And I'm wondering if any of these funds could be used as a soft launch of that idea. Maybe it's within the Department of Health, or maybe it's something that we could use. This is supposed to be transformative, right? I mean, that's the key word, transformative, rather than continuing a system that has frustrated all of us for a long time. In many ways, we see the challenges in many of our silos of healthcare delivery. But if this is transformative, do you see room in the subject areas that you have delineated for at least standing up the federal backbone as part of the RTHP support, looking down the road if we were to move in the direction of a state health authority?
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, through the chair, representative, I think right now all ideas are on the table. I think we're being incredibly thoughtful in terms of listening to healthcare providers, looking at the financing, looking at the revenue cycles, and looking at what are the hard issues and where's our current system. So it's not a yes, it's not a no, it's all options are on the table. So we're going to take steps.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
I have a question. I think, Madam Chair, I'm ultimately, I know, I'm going to support this ARP request, but I'd like to ask our counsel something.
It's perfectly fine. She's online. Yeah.
Okay. Can we go at ease?
Sure. Brief at ease.
Through the chair, Ms. Wallace, are you available?
Through the chair, this is Megan Wallace, Chief Counsel for Legal Services.
Good morning, Ms. Wallace. I'm thinking, and these dates stick with me because it was such a sort of dramatic time for the country, but I'm thinking of two dates, March 28th, 2020, and May 17th, 2020. We effectively left Juneau March 28th, 2020, after 65 days, and then we returned around May 17th, 2020, and we ratified some RPLs through resolution. Is that something you would recommend we do in January 2026?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the ratification that you referred to in 2020 was the result of a lawsuit that was filed. And so the recommendation for what the legislature should do, if anything, might depend upon whether there's any action related to approval of these RPLs. But it is not an uncommon budgetary practice for the finance co-chairs to ratify certain expenditures, whether it's disaster expenditures or ratification of an RPL. Those ratifications can appear in any budget document. And so it would be my recommendation as a matter of assurance that there's no issues with approval of this RPL, that a item be placed in the operating or capital budget next session as the legislature considers its budget.
Follow up?
Certainly.
Would you advise if there's a supplemental budget and it's not instead rolled into a regular budget in May? In other words, if there's a budget that the legislature takes action on, budget bill rather, appropriations bill, early in the session, that this issue be taken up in that instrument?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson. Yes. It's all considered by the legislature. It would just increase insurance of the appropriateness of this RPL.
Okay. Thank you.
Do you have another question? Thank you. Are there any other questions? Okay, I'll withdraw my objection. Are there any objections? Seeing none, then the RPL 16-2026-015 for the Rural Health Transformation Program is approved. Thank you for your presentation. Okay, Speaker Edgman, may I please have a motion for approval of the second RPL?
Yes, Madam Chair. Move and ask unanimous consent that the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee approve RPL from 09/2026/00. RPL number 09-2026-0098, construction of a certified veteran cemetery in Fairbanks for the total of $3,600,000.
Thank you. I'll object for purposes of discussion. Mr. Painter, he's still online with us. And we're also joined in the room by, again, Lacey Sanders, Director of OMB, and then Bob Ernissi, Administrative Services Director, Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Mr. Painter, please introduce this RPL to the committee, and then we'll take questions, if there are any, from the committee members. Mr. Painter?
Thank you. For the record, again, Alexi Painter, Legislative Fiscal Analyst. So this is RPL number 09-2026-0098. The agency is Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. It is a capital project, so the appropriation that it increases is titled Construction of a Certified Veteran Cemetery in Fairbanks Area, and it is for $3.6 million of federal receipts using code 1002. So the legislature has made numerous appropriations of both federal and matching general funds for this project, dating all the way back to FY11. The total appropriations over those years total about $4.5 million of general funds and then $14 million of federal funds. The department just received a federal grant that totals $16.7 million, so that exceeds the amount of federal receipt authority that they have received thus far. This RPL would bring the total amount of federal authority up to $17.6 million. The reason for that difference is that they anticipate some additional federal reimbursement for the cost of the projects beyond the actual grant amount. Since the general fund match has already been appropriated, there are no other state funds needed at this time. I would note that once the capital project is completed, there will be a general fund cost to operate and maintain the cemetery. The department anticipates that. It's probably about $1.3 million. There's not much federal funding for that, so this will be it needs some operating funds from the general fund in the future. But again, at this point, to accept the grant, there is no need for additional general funds. And that's the conclusion of my commentary. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions to Mr. Painter, Dr. Sanders, or Mr. Murdisi? Okay. Well, I'll withdraw my objection. And are there any other objections? Okay. Seeing none, then the RPL is approved. Thank you. We are now at Agenda Item 4G, Overview of the Department of Revenue, Division of Treasury's Non-Routine Investments Policy. This agenda topic is for discussion only, and the committee will not be taking any action on this matter today. But I want to also share some quick background and explain why this issue is on the agenda. In members' package and posted to bases, there are three letters. The first letter, dated September 3rd, 2025, from the Acting Commissioner of the Department of Revenue to the State Auditor, Chris Curtis, titled Fiduciary Reallocation of a Portion of the Constitutional Budget Reserve, CBR, into the subaccount. Second, the presiding officer sent an inquiry to the governor, dated October 14th, seeking additional information and noting that the legislature has an obligation to actively examine the circumstances of this financial commitment and its implications for Alaska's financing. And the third, the governor replied on October 22nd, providing additional information and reiterating that he has requested an independent third-party review of the transaction. We understand that the third-party review is being conducted by the national law firm Wilmer Hill, and it's underway. And we appreciate that offer, and that and we look forward to the outcome, which, according to press reports, it's due before the beginning of the regular legislative session. But at the same time, our own due diligence has led us to the Division of Treasury's non-routine investment policy. With this committee's oversight responsibility, I want to raise awareness and understanding about this policy. Therefore, today, we're going to keep the discussion at a high level, the focus on understanding the policy without getting into any examination of what the former commissioner did or did not take. However, the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee does maintain our responsibility and our authority to take action in the future if and when it is appropriate. Ms. Curtis, please share some history with the committee and explain how the non-routine investment policy originated. Thank you.
For the record, this is Chris Curtis. I'm your state legislative auditor. And I've been asked to talk about changes that the Department of Revenue made to their investment policies as a result of our audit of the Department of Revenue's loan to the Mustang Operations Center number 1. We call that MOC. The investment policies for non-routine investments that were created as a result of the MOC audit are relevant to recent concerns over the Department of Revenue Commissioner Crum's investment in Digital Bridge. So as background, the Division of Legislative Audit released an audit of the Department of Revenue's tax credit-backed loan it made to MOC 1, and that audit is available on our website and is dated July of 2020. The recommendation number 4 of that audit concluded that the Department of Revenue Revenue's commissioner, their decision to loan up to $22.5 million to MOC 1 under the authority of the department's investment statutes was legal. However, the decision was not appropriate when compared with the behavior that a prudent person would consider reasonable. We go on to list 7 actions that supported that conclusion. In my opinion, those actions are a very strong support. In addition, the department did not argue the validity of that conclusion. We go on to say that a lack of procedures governing non-routine investments and a lack of formal oversight of Department of Revenue Commissioner's investment function contributed to the deficiencies that we found. Now, statutes provide the commissioner with authority to invest the state monies, but there are no statutory provisions that provide for formal ongoing oversight of the commissioner's investment function. In contrast, the state's pension funds are subject to oversight by the Alaska Retirement Management Board. The ARM Board determines the appropriate investment objectives, obtains an external performance review to evaluate the investment policies, and submits investment performance reports to the Legislative Budget Audit Committee. This oversight function provides transparency and assurance over the propriety of pension investments. Now, in the audit, we recommended the legislature consider enhancing the oversight of the Department of Revenue's investment function. And in response to this recommendation, the then Commissioner Mahoney agreed that procedures should be improved and stated that she was planning on establishing a non-political external investment commission to advise the department. Now, flash forward to the end of 2021 when this committee established its new audit oversight process. In that first year, I presented the top audit issues. This recommendation number 4 from the MOC 1 audit was a top audit issue. And so we reached out to the Commissioner of Revenue, asked for the current status of the corrective action for this recommendation, and you have a copy in your meeting packets, and I believe I also handed it out before the meeting started, a copy of Commissioner Mahoney's response to the status of the corrective action. As you can read, the Commission of the Department of Revenue instituted investment procedures governing non-routine investments as a result of the Mach 1 audit. Now, there's a link in that letter to their website that you can view those procedures. But they also are summarized at the bottom of the page, and I'm going to go ahead and read them for the public and for the members. So number one, the first of eight procedures that were added for non-routine investments was to document the investment opportunity and determine if it merits further diligence and or if it's more suitable for other funding sources. Number two, seek legal advice on Department of Revenue's eligibility. Three, seek advice from external auditors. Four, use an impartial external expert to evaluate the opportunity and provide an opinion on the investment. Five, seek advice from the Investment Advisory Council. Six, notify the Office of Management and Budget. Seven, complete the diligence and investment documentation. And lastly, to inform the chairs of the Senate and House Finance Committees of the decision to move forward the non-routine investment. So Department of Revenue's investment policies are available on a public the public-facing website, and we went out and looked to see those policies and compared them to the 2021 investment policies. They are slightly different, but they are very similar. I know there's concerns regarding Commissioner Crum's non-routine investment in Digital Bridge, and I just wanted to highlight for the public and for members that there were policies put in place to address the concerns that were brought up from the mock audit. So these procedures existed at the time Commissioner Crum made the decision to invest in Digital Bridge.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Stedman?
Several. I don't know where we're going here. That's not the only issue that we faced with the Department of Revenue years. We had an incident outside of that where we had the sub-account substantially added to, and the commissioner at the time asked Senator Hoffman and myself to sign a letter, not that we authorize anything, just aware of what he's going to do. Our response was, don't do it, we're not signing the damn letter. And sure enough, 3-4 weeks later, we're down $1 billion in the CBR, and that went over like a lead bone. So this is the third incident, not the second. The Mustang, there's the issue of the ill-timed, aggressive investments. And clearly, under both those situations, the commissioner has the authority to do it. Nobody's questioning the broad authority that the commissioner has. And they're all a little different. I think on the Mustang caper, it was well-intended, misguided. I think the money's ended up in China through funnel through Singapore. Okay? Where the million or the $1 billion went in the CBR, somebody else's pocket, it wasn't the state. Obviously, in a declining market, you had to spend some time to recoup that. And then several years ago, 4 or 5, I'd have to go back and look at the date, when we liquidated the sub-account and the CBR was put into all of the more highly liquid side, because there was ample concern that we were going to need to draw on these funds. That was about 4 years. Maybe we'll timeline this out some of the meeting. And then we fast forward to the last couple of months, where there was significant concern and discussion between us and administration over the last 3 years on the appropriate account balance of the CB, because we were concerned that we were going to get into a liquidity crisis. And we did not come to an agreement with the restriction and still have. The Finance Committee, at least in the Senate, wants to see a higher account balance than $3 billion as a target. When we went into this last year budget process, there was considerable discussion at the table throughout the legislature, particularly those in leadership and Finance Committee, of the need for liquidity. We all have different opinions and different backgrounds. But it was agreed to through the budget process that we were not going to CPR. We had projected revenue reductions given to us by the Department of Revenue and DNR on production, that oil prices, you know, are severely under pressure. And clearly that was coming out of Washington also and in all the press, frankly, worldwide. So we set out last year's budget to try to balance it at $66. We ended at $68, if I remember correctly, in the final bill, and not go into the CPR. And the reason we didn't go into the CPR is the liquidity potential need, which means we probably have substantial draws on the CPR over the next 2 or 3 years, potentially liquidating it in 2 years. The administration wanted $1.5 billion out of the CBR last year, 1.5 of the three. Okay? That's the significance of what we're talking about. Now, we can get into all the fancy documents we want to get into, which we will, but when it comes right down to the basics of liquidity and when you need to draw on your funds, and I think there's some guidance that we can look at, which actually calls for the CBR to be in Treasury bills 3 months or less. And even if they were a year or a year and a half out, I mean, it passes the red face test. We don't need the whole thing in there. 8 years, 10 years, illiquid, doesn't pass the red face test at all. And I don't think they can get by a compliance. So it doesn't pass the test of reasonable in any shape or form under any compliance review to put the state in that particular position, especially, and I don't know what kind of dollar amounts we're talking about, we haven't got into it here, but my understanding from reading the press, it could be in excess of $200 million. Now, if we liquidated $1.5 billion, we only had $1.5 left, and you tie up $200 to $250 million, I think we have an incompetence issue. And that's give them the, I guess, the high road. Gross incompetence. This is different than under the Walker administration when we lost the billion. That was just inexperience. That was unfortunate, embarrassing for the department. Happened. The Mustang issue here, by then acting our deputy commissioner at the time, I think if I remember correctly, his role, just well-meaning, poorly reviewed. This is gross incompetence.
Thank you, Senator.
We've got an issue.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Rich Curtis. Speaker Edgman.
I don't get to follow up on those comments. Try to just throw something out there. So I think this is going to merit a pretty obvious response, but the third part of review that's being conducted by executive branch, was there any consultation at all with the state or in terms of what perhaps might be in terms of
through the chair, are you talking about when these are put in place in 2021? Are there any questions about what type
of it would be? I apologize to be more clear. I'm talking about the issue at hand here, the current 2025 issue, the third party review that's supposed to be taking place or to recommendations or whatever it is due to the legislation before the start of the session. But were you consulted on it?
Was I consulted on review of the investments? No. Through the chair, we are looking at this issue. It's part of our FY25 single audit, so it's an ongoing audit and confidential. So being here today was just to raise awareness that there are policies out there governing specifically the type of investment Commissioner Crum entered into, and just wasn't sure whether people were aware of those and the fact that they were put in place to address concerns we had brought up in the Mach 1 audit.
As a follow-up, so thank you for that, and I understand the sort of purpose of this discussion. Sure. The committee, but I was just trying to ascertain. A lot of times when we ask for a review, you know, questions are very pertinent to what kind of product the product is going to be for us. Just wondering if you had had any involvement, in whatever, in terms of that review might be regarding this digital investment money that Senator Stedman, I think, laid out very clearly. And so I just wanted to...
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, and I don't want you to speculate, Ms. Curtis, but could the former commissioner said, given this corrective action 8-item list, that the investment made that's in dispute was routine and within the scope of its existing investment profile?
Through the chair, I really comment on that. I mean, I could. whether I should or not, I don't know. I don't believe I should. Because this is an ongoing audit, and we are actively.
Okay, and I can check the media accounts and see what he said. I don't. Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Curtis, for honoring the confidentiality. Appreciate that. Are there any other Senator Stead?
I got a little more background. So let's back up to Governor Murkowski's reign as governor. Under his administration, then Revenue Commissioner, the Revenue Commissioner put together a loose-knit support staff within the Department of Revenue, other departments, to counsel his decisions. And I think they had quarterly meetings. And they did that because of the awesome authority that the Revenue Commissioner has. Frankly, to help when he makes a decision, justify the decision, the information at that time. We all know going forward, things change in finance investment. And then as the administration's changed, we have numerous times over the years asked every revenue commission, are you having these meetings? And they were stopped for quite a few years. Mustang surfaced. We were concerned with that. The issue with under Walker with the $1 billion loss. When we were concerned that these meetings were taking place, and the Commissioner of Revenue should have counsel. And when that $1 billion went out the door, we had the consultants from that's our retirement plan, permanent fund, and we asked them at the Finance Committee if they were counseled on these decisions. And they did everything but run out the door. They didn't want anything to do with it because it was so egregious. The permanent fund wouldn't put billions of dollars in the market in a handful of days. So bad it was. Still just inexperience, mainly chalk it up to the this winter, when they come for us, looking forward to asking Cal, what are they doing in their counsel to our employees at the state and our commissioners? Now, the Commissioner of Revenue sits on the board of the Permanent Fund. Mm-hmm. Callan counsels the board of the Permanent Fund and the retirement. And there is literally a gross level of incompetence that is, to me, just beyond belief that you could be this far off the mark. And you can hire all the consultants you want, attorneys from out of state, and pay them whatever, generate anything you want, and it still can't pass the red paste test. And you're in a liquidity environment, a need for liquidity within a fairly short time, a year or two, and this year we'll probably need a chunk of that seat. The way it looks, and you got to have a good investment. You can't tie it up for 10 years. The permanent fund could do it. They have a huge allocation in the billions for these type of investments. That's fine. Not our savings account. We need to have on our school to make our So there is the, you know, when we're talking about earlier here, outside counsel that you're talking about, that is, I think, part of that historical issue. And when they had these meetings going on with the Department of Revenue, helping the commissioner justify his decision, you know, have a sounding, they didn't have issues. And in, I don't recall any of them coming up that, you know, that would make you, you know, get concerned. So, yeah, we have a problem. And we also have an interest here at the committee, at least this guy does here. I want to know when the governor knew it, when the attorney general knew it, how far the information went, was there outside counsel used? I want to know some of these answers. And I want to know the cash flow timing. And I've also been approached by several lobbyists that were contacted to lobby for more contracts signed with other firms. And some of the lobbyists I talked to didn't want to sign up that customer because it was so egregious, they wouldn't even. Hang on, it's going to be interesting.
Thank you, Senator Stedman, and I'm sure I can speak for the committee. We're all looking forward to having some questions answered. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, well, remember, Megan Wallace, who's our chief counsel for Legislative Legal Services, she's still online and she's available for any questions about the relevant statutes governing the management of a CBR. So if there are any questions for Ms. Wallace, now is your opportunity. Huh? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Curtis, and thank you, Ms. Wallace. We're now at number five, executive session. So the committee will now be going into executive session for consideration of a contract extension for IRS Alder, an RFP for the lease of office space in Anchorage for the Division of Legislative Audit, the final release of sunset audits of the Board of Marital and Family Therapy and the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners, and to receive a legal update on the special audit titled Oil and Gas Production Tax Audit. Speaker Esmond, may I please have a motion?
Take a brief at ease, please.
Brief at ease. back on the record at 11:38 a.m., and we're at item number 5, executive session. Speaker Edgman, may I please have a motion?
I move and ask unanimous consent that the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee go into executive session under Rule 22B1, discussion of matters, immediate knowledge of which adversely affect the finances of a government unit, and Uniform Rule 22B3, discussion of a matter that may, by law, be required to be confidential. The following individuals may remain or online during executive session: Chris Curtis and any staff, legislative auditor, Emily Nauman and Megan Wallace from Legal Services, J.C. Kestel, human officer, any legislators not in the LBNA committee, and any staff in the LBNA committee.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Okay, if there's no objection, then the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee will now go into executive session. So let's just take a brief at ease while we clear the room. Brief at ease.
Recording is off. To resume recording, press star 9 again.
Back on the record at 12:26. We're now out of the executive session, and again, back on the record at 12:26 p.m. Following members are present: Representative Josephson, Representative Copps, Representative Tilton, Speaker Edgman, Senator Stedman, Senator Giesel, Senator Wilikowski online, and myself, so we have a quorum to conduct business. During the executive session, we'll discuss the topics listed on the agenda. Next, the committee will take action on several of those topics. IRS holder contract extension. Ms. Curtis, for the public record, please share a quick summary of the contract extension related to IRS holder. Thank you.
For the record, this is Chris Curtis. I'm your state legislative auditor. So today I've asked the committees for your consideration and approval of a contract extension with BDMP Assurance, and they're the contractor that we use to test the general and application controls for the state's financial system. That's IRIS, their financial accounting system, and their financial accounting reporting system, which is ALDER. That work is needed to support our FY26 audit opinion and our FY26 single audit. And this is the third and last one-year extensions that is allowed for 2022 procurement for this contract. So this will be the last extension we have for that procurement. And again, the amount is not to exceed $176,000, and we do have budget to cover the cost of this work.
Any questions? Okay, seeing none, Mr. Speaker, I have a motion regarding the consideration of the contract extension.
I move and ask unanimous consent that the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee authorize the legislative auditor to amend the current contract, BDMP Assurances LLP, for information technology expertise, to extend the contract for the review of the FY26 general and application controls of the state's accounting and reporting systems for an additional amount not to exceed $176,000 to be paid existing funds.
Is there any? Okay, seeing none, the contract is approved. Okay, lease extension for office space in Anchorage for the Division of Legislative Audit. Ms. Curtis, for the public record, please share a quick summary of the lease extension for the Division of Legislative Audit's Anchorage office space.
Certainly, this is Chris Curtis, your state legislative auditor. So we did a competitive procurement for new office space for our Anchorage office, and that RFP was not successful in generating any reasonable office offers. So we're planning on going out for another competitive procurement, but unfortunately that's going to leave us with no office space for a period of 6 months. So we are asking for your approval of a written justification for a non-competitive short-term lease to hold us over between the current one and the future long-term lease. We have a written justification. We believe this lease qualifies for non-competitive procurement in accordance with Section 040D of the Legislative Procurement Code. And that is because we have tried to do a competitive procurement. It was not successful. We did not foresee that to be the case when we did the RFP. We need to modify our current lease to allow us to stay in place for 6 months. The rate will be $4,992 a month and 52 cents for a period not to exceed 6 months, for a total amount for the six-month period of $29,997.12. So again, we're asking for your approval of the short-term, non-competitive lease to allow us to enter or complete the competitive procurement process for a long-term lease.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Curtis? Okay, Mr. Speaker, may I please have a motion for a lease extension for the Division of Legislative Anchorage office space?
I move and ask unanimous consent that the committee under Section 040E of the Legislative Procurement Code approve a material amendment to the Division of Legislative Audit's Anchorage office space lease at 33 E Street, Suite 100, to extend the lease for 6 months for a total amount lease period of $29,997.12 with existing ones.
Thank you. Is there any objection? Okay, seeing none, motion is approved. Okay, final release of audits. Speaker Edgman, may I have a motion for the release of the final audit reports?
I move asking unanimous consent, Legislative Budget and Audit Committee release the following audits as final audit reports. 1, the Board of Marital and Family Therapy. 2, Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners.
Is there any objection? Okay, then the final audits are released. Thank you. Okay, this is just a statement on the legal update on the special audit. While we were in executive session, the committee received a brief legal update on the special audit titled Oil and Gas Production Tax Audit Process. Per statute, the audit process is confidential, and neither I nor any members of the committee are permitted to comment publicly at this stage. As I've said before, we really appreciate the public's patience and understanding as this work proceeds. We are now at agenda item 6, adjournment. Do members have any comments before we adjourn? Okay, I have a couple. Some of you may be familiar with the Levin Center for Oversight and Democracy, as their regular centers at NCSL and CSG and other legislative conferences. The Levin Center's objectives include, number one, improving the practice of oversight in state legislators across the country by way of trainings and events with lawmakers and staff, and number two, increasing the visibility of legislative oversight as an essential legislative function. So I'm really excited to share with you that, you know, my staff and I are working to bring a couple of members of their staff to Juneau to conduct trainings during the beginning of the legislative session. So the initial planning is underway, but we'll be sharing more information with you as it becomes available in the coming weeks. So before we end, I just want to thank Chris and our staff again, and I want to thank Emily and Meg, and also JC and the other presenters today, the LIO staff, Juno staff online, and of course Jeff, who always makes my life so easy chairing this committee. Thank you, Jeff. And I also want to thank the committee members for always making the attendance meeting a priority. I appreciate that. So I want you to have a good lunch. We're going to be back here at 1:30 for presentations on the Alaska LNG project from Gaffney Klein, AGDC, in Glen Forum, Alaska. So this morning's meeting is adjourned at 12:33 p.m.